Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Connolly, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You may be seated. The first matter on our calendar is Midland Funding versus Joy Ford. It's A19-1887. And when you, you'll each have 15 minutes for your arguments, 5 for rebuttal if you choose to use it for appellant. When you begin your argument, please state your name for the record. We're being recorded. And we're ready to proceed if you are.
May it please the court, my name is Darren Schwiebert and I represent the appellant Joy Ford. This is not a simple, straightforward consumer credit card case. There are two factors that significantly complicate this case and make it very different from a simple, straightforward consumer credit card case. The first is the United States government's injunction consent order. It's in the record at Index 51, Exhibit B. That is the order of the CFPB finding, among other things, that these respondents, many of the affidavits that they submit in their attempt to obtain judgment contain false and misleading statements. That's paragraph 54. And that statements regarding the chain of title are often made without reviewing the underlying documentations. That's paragraphs 58 and 59. The federal government investigated their debt collection practices and found they were false and misleading. The second complicating
factor. Is that in the record?
It is. It's at Index 51, Exhibit B.
And what's the date of that injunction?
The injunction was entered on September 17th, 2015.
My understanding was that Midland and other people, other groups that were subject to the injunction changed their practices in light of the injunction. At least that's what Midland says in some of the things that are in the record.
There's no evidence in the record other than lawyer argument, which isn't evidence, that there's been any changes. And in fact, in the reply brief, we do a kind of side-by-side comparison between the Midland v. Schlick affidavit, which a panel of this court held was not admissible, and the current affidavit of Ms. Wozniak, and they contain the same allegations. But more importantly, for the purposes of this appeal, what the government's injunction consent order shows is why the 5604 motion should have been granted to allow the deposition of the person putting in that affidavit, who's had a history being at that company of having false and misleading affidavits and statements, to allow us to discover what was actually reviewed. Were these statements
Can I just have you direct your attention to the respondent's brief on page 22? Because there is a comparison between the Midland affidavit and the in the Schlick case with the affidavit here.
Yes.
Would you agree there is a difference between the two affidavits?
They've added additional lines to their form affidavit, but the additional lines don't address the problem either in the United States government's order and don't address the problem of admissibility. It still doesn't establish that Ms. Wozniak has personal knowledge to authenticate the documents or that her affidavit is based on admissible evidence. So,
but there's a definite statement here. I have access to and reviewed electronic records pertaining to the account maintained by the servicer and am authorized to make this affidavit on plaintiff's behalf. And then she goes into what the electronic records reviewed consist of. And then she also talks about the training and that this is done in the regular course of business and as a business record. The argument of counsel for the respondent is that all of this information was done in response to this consent order.
That's their argument. There's no evidence that that's actually true.
Well, and except what? I mean, they're doing.
They actually say it was done.
The order requires by doing this affidavit, and they're going through in more detail and more explicit. I mean, what evidence do you have that they didn't do what the affidavit said they did do?
Okay. First of all, what counsel
is there anything in the record?
It's the United States government's injunction consent order. What they're doing is comparing the Schlick affidavit to this affidavit, not the affidavits that are the subject of the consent order. Right, where the federal government, in looking at their affidavit, says this party, Midland and Midland Credit Management, has a pattern of false affidavits.
Well, but again, they're whether it's in response to the Schlick order or whether it's in response to the consent order, this affidavit is different.
It does contain additional statements.
Being done.
But it still doesn't establish that Ms. Wozniak has any knowledge regarding Comenity Bank's records.
Well, what do you think our standard of review is? Because Judge Gilligan determined the admissibility or unadmissibility of this particular affidavit.
Yes, and I think that he committed legal error in doing that. And I'll go through a couple of specific examples.
Well, typically, you would agree with me that we review evidentiary rulings for abuse of discretion.
Right, and he abuses his discretion when he allows evidence which is not admissible, which is a violation of the rules of evidence. His view is that because it was reviewed by Ms. Wozniak, that it, therefore she has personal knowledge to authenticate it and to establish the business record rule. And there's lots of problems with the business record rule we'll talk about, but if he's not properly applying the Minnesota rules of evidence, then he is abusing his discretion. That's our position. The second thing that takes us out of the realm of a simple, straightforward consumer case are the FDCPA claims. As the Tolentino decision held, and it appears that the principal brief at 32, the public as a whole has an interest in the vindication of FDCPA rights, and they cannot be valued simply in monetary terms. There are five FDCPA claims at issue, four of which were improperly granted summary judgment to the respondents, and one which was the subject of the motion to amend. And that's where I'd like to start. The district court simply denied the motion to amend as moot. That's the words that appear on page 24 of the addendum. It's page 23 of his order. Legally, the motion to amend was not moot. It would have had a practical effect on the existing controversy. We would not be here on appeal if the court had granted the motion to amend. The district court should have granted the motion to amend under the Enval standard. But he doesn't get to the analysis of should it be granted or should it not be granted. He simply, in one word, uses the word moot, which is not getting to the underlying. There's a lot of debate in the briefing about the legal standard about to apply to it. The simple reality is, under either legal standard, he is incorrect. Rather, the de novo standard, or whether or not he's committed a legal error, it is not moot as a matter of law, and therefore it should be reversed and remanded back down to the district court for a determination on the motion to amend the counterclaim. That counterclaim is based on their failure to comply with the United States government injunction consent order. And in particular, in paragraph 131B, which requires them to send a very specific notice before they file a lawsuit. They did not send that notice. That's a violation of the FDCPA and would have other effects on that case because they have failed to comply with the injunction, which they consented to, issued by the United States government. The second FDCPA claim I'd like to talk about is the one under Minnesota Statute 358.116. The conciliation court rules require compliance with 358.116 if an attorney is going to file the complaint called a statement of claim. That's the Minnesota General Rules of Practice 507A. The district court at Addendum 21 found they failed to comply. Okay, so we're that far into the analysis. Then the district court.
Counsel, the whole issue of the county and state?
Yes.
Okay.
It's, you got to list the county. The district court's right, you have to list the county. They don't. It's not there. Then the court commits legal error, abused his discretion in granting summary judgment on the claim by importing a new legal term, unfair or unconscionable, into the F1 claim. The district court has no citations for that proposition. The respondents on appeal have no legal citations for that position. In fact, all of the federal cases that have looked at this question say, because of the way the FDCPA is structured, that's not required. Congress has already made that determination. That's the Lindblom and Allen cases. And the three recent Supreme Court cases, Rodkiski, Adusky, and Santander, all FDCPA cases by the United States Supreme Court, all saying don't import new limitations. Because they failed to do that, it was a violation of the FDCPA. That's the Simon and Haney cases. And the district court abused its discretion in improperly interpreting the FDCPA.
Now, in opposition to your client's motion to amend, respondents submitted the pre-legal notification letter that was sent to her prior to the commencement of the conciliation court action, and that's in the record.
Yes. There are two pieces about the pre-litigation notice. The first is her affidavit says she didn't receive it, right? Her affidavit, which is in the record. The second is, and I put it in the reply brief, there's a side-by-side chart between the requirements of Section 131A, which is what 131B requires them to do, and their actual letter. It is an exhibit, which was attached to the motion to amend, but I also put the actual exhibit in our reply brief so the court could look side-by-side and see that. It's on page 19 of the reply brief. The left-hand column is what they claim to have sent. The right-hand column is what the injunction requires them to send. And I think it's supposed to be bolded, although it gets a little squished by the time it gets, the image gets put in the brief. They failed to include the required language. The final FDCPA claim has to do with whether or not there was meaningful involvement in their review of the complaint. And Bach v. Pressler and Pressler, which is a Midland case, involves the same factual situation where the signing of the claim was a violation of 1692E3, even though they didn't review the chain of title. In this case, their own training guide, which is in the record, shows they don't instruct them to review the chain of title. The district court relied on the mysterious Exhibit B in granting summary judgment. Exhibit B, which turns out to be an interrogatory.
Switch to just one question I had.
Yep.
And I appreciate the necessity for strict compliance. And perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong. So as I understand it, your client denies that she ever opened this credit card or signed any agreements, or would that be, am I wrong on that? Or?
You are correct.
Okay.
That she denies the contract.
Right.
That she saw it, that's in her affidavit.
Yes.
That was submitted to the district court. She hasn't seen that contract. She saw it for the first time. She didn't agree to it. She testified at the conciliation court hearing that she opened a credit card, right? But there's nothing in the record that says this is her account.
Was there something in the record, and perhaps again I'm confused, that she actually made a payment on this credit card, though?
There is no evidence that she made a payment on this credit card.
But there is evidence that a payment had been made.
There are business records of Comenity Bank, which indicate that payments were made in those statements. But that doesn't establish that she made any of those payments. She's not deposed in the case. There's no testimony that she made any payments or received anything in conjunction with it. All they have are the business records of Comenity Bank.
And those show her name, that the statements were mailed to someone named Joy Ford at her address.
They don't actually even show that they're mailed. They just have her name and address on them. There isn't any evidence in the record that those were mailed even.
Well, those are copies of billing statements
that are electronic media that Comenity Bank creates, and there's no one Mr. Redke, who's the only Community Bank person, doesn't attach anything or authenticate any documents.
Well, didn't at the conciliation court hearing, didn't she admit that she had, that this was her account, that she had opened it, but she disputed the amount?
That's not correct.
That was due and owing.
What she said was that she had a credit card. She didn't know if this one was hers or not, which is why the conciliation court order, which I excerpted and put right in the brief, says she admitted she had a credit card. She never admits she had this one, and she didn't know it was with Comenity Bank, who's the original creditor in this case.
Does the record indicate which credit card she had? Or did she know which one she had? So just know she opened a credit card.
Okay. And she believed that the one credit card she opened was paid off. That was her testimony quoted by the conciliation court referee in his opinion. Authentication and admissibility.
And you have 6 seconds. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I understand. The most important part of all of that issue, which is the other half of the brief, is the fact that nobody with personal knowledge of Comenity Bank's records actually submits them in this case. What comes in is not Comenity Bank, and nobody submits any authentication for that summary data printed document, which we'll talk about in rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. Derek Weber of Messerlin Kramer appearing on behalf of the respondents. Also present in the court is Stephanie Lamphier, an attorney with our office. I'll be presenting the brief today. May it please the court, before the court is actually a simple $500 case that originated in conciliation court where judgment was entered in favor of respondent Midland Funding. And thereafter, the case was appealed to district court and litigation exploded. The center point of the—
Respond to the county-state argument. I mean, it seems to me, like it or not, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act does seem to require strict compliance, and whether that's right or wrong, I assume you concede you didn't comply with putting the county name, right?
So the county name is actually in the document in a different location. It says it right at the top, but not near the signature.
The law required to be near the signature?
Well, I mean, we use the court form, which doesn't have it, and then the statute says you should have it. Okay. And so we kind of have to concede that it's not there, right. And we have to concede what the law says. But what we don't have—
Why isn't that a problem? Why don't you lose then?
So why we don't have to concede is that is an FDCPA violation, and we've cited a number of cases—
That it's not?
That it is not an FDCPA violation.
What case or part of the statute says that?
So— You know, in our briefing, we've labeled two different lines of thinking on that, Your Honor. One is that...
I appreciate lines of thinking, but I'm actually interested to know what case or statute.
Fair enough. Then I'll pull out the specific
I have my own
ones.
Line of thinking, and sometimes the Supreme Court agrees and sometimes they don't.
And I apologize. I'll have to find it, but it's...
All right, well, you can go on to the rest of your argument.
So the first type of cases that are out there. I do have it in my argument, so let me just get to that.
And when you say the county name does appear, where does it appear?
It's actually, County of Ramsey, State of Minnesota, in kind of the top caption. That's where the court form has it to begin with. And that's where we put it in as well. So the technical violations is the Donahue case, where mere technical falsehoods that mislead no one are not violations. That's one citation, and that's the one line of thinking that we believe is appropriate in the situation. The other is one that talks about minor errors, and our own Judge Doty and Heroe talks about minor errors are not violations and not
those
to be.
Both those cases are fair debt collect practice.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So, but before the center point of appellant's case has really been the admissibility of evidence. And I would really like to talk about that, because before the trial court were the account billing statements from a zero balance all the way through to the charge-off balance, which is what was sued for. And also before the court were the terms and conditions in the bill of sale transferring the account from Comenity to Midland. But so Midland presented its affidavit and attached those records, but also attached the affidavit of Comenity, which laid the foundation of how those records were created. So you have to take those two affidavits together. That's how they were presented. And counsel likes to split those apart, and appellant likes to split those apart, saying, well, this independently is not sufficient, and this independently is not sufficient. But that's not what they are. Midland said, here are the records provided to us from Comenity, and Comenity's affidavit said, we transferred all of our records to Midland. And so those together satisfy the National T standard.
I have in front of me the affidavit and the bill of sale and then this electronic record.
Sure.
So if you look at the asset schedule, doesn't tell me anything.
Correct.
And so I was trying to figure out how we get to Ms. Ford then being part of that asset sale.
Sure. Couple of lines of thinking on that. First of all, the asset sale has a very large Excel spreadsheet with multiple accounts. And so what has to be done is all that has to be redacted out, because only one line or only one account relates to Ms. Ford's, which is what you have there in the data that's extracted from that. And it says that. It says this is the data extracted from the bill of sale. So here's the stuff that's unique to Ms. Ford's, and it doesn't have John Doe's and Mary Rowe's information on it so that it can be used in a court of law. Second thing is, in addition to that as evidence that the account was transferred, all the other accounts records were transferred. So the billing statements that had the account number on it, her name, her balance, her address, all that information was transferred as well. And so taking in conjunction, you have the redacted bill of sale from the records, and you have all of the records, and then you have the affidavit. It is clear that Midland has established that the account was transferred to it. That's fair.
I understand the argument of the appellant here, correct me if I misstate it, but I think they're saying it appears that you're just trying to piggyback a business records exception on another business record exception, there's not evidence here to support that, and that's not an admissible way to present evidence here.
Sure. So actually, his presentation this morning established that those were the business records of Comenity. That's what he said before you earlier. He said those actually were Comenity's business records. Okay. And the affidavit of Redding says we transferred the transferred documents to Midland. And Midland's affidavit said these are the documents we received. And so there isn't a one affidavit that says, I know of Midland's practices and I know of Comenity's practice and everything, and I know about, I've reviewed all these things. It's they're two taken together, and that's how.
Following up on Judge Hooten's excellent question. I mean, I think you need. I think you need that magic language. At least, it's as I understand the business records. I mean, it's not just, I sent you all the records, I got all the records. It's supposed to be, I am familiar with the records. It is our business practice to have these type of records. These are the true and correct copies of these records. And I know that because I keep those records. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether that's, well, so if that is the true rule, haven't you, isn't it a violation for the district court to have relied on your affidavits to satisfy the business records rule?
So, no, because Comenity's affidavit says just what you said.
Okay.
And Comenity's affidavit establishes it. And then Midland said, we brought those records and made them part of our business records. And then Midland's affidavit says just that. It says those are now part of our records, and we made those as part of our records. And so the transfer, the National T case has been interpreted by a number of courts, and in Stahili is probably the one you're more familiar with, where they submitted an affidavit saying, we know what the business records are of the original creditor. Here, the affiant didn't have to say that because she had the sworn testimony of Comenity already saying, this is our business practice. And so that's the one piece of it that kind of connects together on this. I think what Midland's produced is better. In other words, Midland didn't say, I know about Comenity and here's their business practices and this is how they do things. Midland said, Here's our business practice. We have all this. And by the way, here's Comenity's business practice. And they relied on Comenity to provide their own testimony with respect to that.
Would you please address your opponent's argument regarding mootness? How can you decide that a claim is moot if you don't address it?
Well, I think that the judge actually did. I don't think it's fair to say that he just said it isn't moot. He said, in light of the court's decision. The 25 or 22 previous pages of his discussing and analyzing and looking at the facts of this case, he says, in light of that, I'm saying it's moot. And so he's saying, look, I've already looked at this case. I've already determined that Midland had the account records that came in, that the account records established the account, that the defendant, the appellant, did not produce a credible argument defending against it. I've looked at all the practices and procedures of Messerly and Midland, and I find nothing. And in light of all that, I'm not going to allow one more claim. Now, in addition, the court also had, as you pointed out, Your Honor, they had the actual notice that was sent to Ms. Riley or to Ms. Ford, which, like everything else, I don't remember receiving. And so the evidence was overwhelming. The court said, in light of all this, I'm saying it's moot. We're done. And this is a $500 case, and this is where the court stepped up and said, we need to have some proportionality. Counsel says that all FDCPA cases are important to the public, and yet that's not exactly entirely true. Some are, for sure, but you have to have an important fact that is important to the public. None of these things are. Ms. Ford is really merely taking these FDCPA cases and using them as an offense to avoid paying her legitimate debt. And so what you see is
this. I understand that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to thought Wells Fargo was a very honest company and complied with all the rules. And lo and behold, big surprise. So, and then looking at the language. So in looking at the language on page 22 of your brief, so what language should we be focusing on to indicate that the affidavit complies with the business records rule? Is it the second paragraph that I should be looking at?
So, yes, the second paragraph of Midland's affidavit, but also then you, and it's not in the brief, but it's in the record, the Redding affidavit, which talks about Comenity's practices in creating the business records. So I do want to address briefly, Your Honors, regarding Messerly's practices, because counsel likes to point at us and say we're subject to the government consent decree. It wasn't about us. That's a Midland thing. He likes to point out that our practices are in violation of the FDCPA, and it's not fair, okay? Particularly regarding meaningful involvement, he says our training manual doesn't require the chain of title review. It does. It's in the record, and it says that. And it's not a fair statement to attack us, counsel, for the plaintiff in this matter. We meaningfully involved it. The review. We reviewed extensively. I'm proud of the work that our attorneys have done in this case and what they have done in other cases. And it's a little disturbing to have that attack being made, particularly when it's not based on true statements. The most important thing, I think, is that the judge Judge Gilligan was in the best place to analyze, was Messerly meaningfully involved? Was Messerly, his attorneys, were they participating in the case? I think clearly he is in the best position to know that, and he determined that they were.
But how did he do that if he didn't permit discovery or a deposition?
He did permit discovery, and that's why counsel is able to get all of our procedures and all of our information. That was all exchanged. All the written discovery was provided, and the judge noted that. He said, look, you've got all this documentation. There's no need for more. This is a simple case, and we have to limit it in proportion to the case
but,
and controversy.
I mean, presumably, if the appellant was allowed to depose the author of the affidavit and, you know, it would not be the first time that someone's statement under oath of deposition somehow varies from what the affidavit is. At least, I mean, that used to happen quite a bit because at least the business people that I worked with would sign anything just to get it off their desk. And then, oh, it does say that. So, I mean, presumably he could have punched, he could have had the opportunity to punch holes in the affidavit's author in a deposition. Would that be a fair statement?
Certainly you can do that in any case, but then we can never have summary judgment, right? I mean, then I could just simply say...
Oh, you just have to have a deposition before you have summary judgment.
No, you can't, because you don't know who's going to be the deponent of the... You don't know who's going to be the affiant of the summary judgment motion. So you have to wait till he files, which is what he did. He waited till we filed summary judgment, so then he could say, okay, now I want to take that person's affidavit.
And
so,
Fair enough.
But, well... Respectfully, we request, the judge spent a lot of time on this, Judge Gilligan spent a lot of time going through all this. We don't believe he abused his discretion. We believe he really thoughtfully and thoroughly reviewed the case, and we believe that you should affirm his decision, and we thank you for your time.
Okay. Any rebuttal?
The Red K affidavit, it's index 28. In my version, it's page 70 of it. It may be a little bit different because it was filed confidentially. Mr. Redcave, on behalf of Comenity Bank, never says anything about Joy Ford or Joy Ford's account or anything else. There is a paragraph, it's number 5, in which he says some records were transferred, and he calls them transferred records, capital T, capital R, but never identifies what they are.
So is it your position that in any case where you're suing on credit card debt, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act requires an affidavit under the business records rule, which specifically says, I have personally reviewed, in this case, Joy Ford's credit account, and, you know, according to the rules, and she owes the money. Are you saying that's what's required?
No, that's not the claim in this appeal, because that's the side of the case, which is the debt case, the breach of contract case.
Well, does the law require an affidavit of that specificity?
Yes, because the law requires authenticity, and it requires
and
they satisfy...
What case should I be looking at to establish that principle?
Midland v. Schlick is probably the best.
Okay. So I can look at the consent decree and specifically says... Yep, that's what you got to do now.
Well, the consent decree says here's the pre-notice litigation you have to provide.
Right.
Midland v. Schlick and the cases on the business record exception from this case says you have to lay the foundations of the business. Problem is you have two totally separate parties.
But Midland v. Schlick is an unpublished case
by
this court, and it is a 2013 case, which is 2 years earlier than the consent decree.
That's correct. There is no tie between those two things. Midland v. Schlick and actually a case they cite and a bunch of other cases are all excluding these affidavits, not based on the consent order. What the consent order does is lay the background for what I thought was a pretty reasonable request to take the deposition of the person. Now, they say they can never get summary judgment. But remember, the judge, while denying us the opportunity to take her deposition, relies on her affidavit in order to grant a summary judgment. So once you enter that situation where the only evidence is the testimony of the person whose company has a history of false and deceptive affidavits, we should have been given permission to go ahead. But nothing in Red K talks about Ford or attaches these documents. The only document that ties Ms. Ford to this is this data printed document, which the court refers to as the summary. They refused to produce the electronic underlying file. That's the 1006 admissibility problem, right? One of the things we were seeking in the 5604 motion is give us that electronic file.
They said that you didn't raise
They alleged we did. We waived it.
Yeah.
There's two problems with that. The first is we specifically addressed the inadmissibility of the data printed in our briefing, page 10 and 11. And in the 5604 motion, what we're seeking specifically is that that electronic file. And that, the record citation for that specific point, is in index number 58 and paragraphs 10 and 14 and exhibit F, which is the discovery we served on Midland, asking for that electronic file. Now, all of it was heard at one time at the district court, so we didn't have the opportunity to have them successfully refuse to produce it and then rely on it at summary judgment. But what should have happened was the 5604 motion should have been granted. We should have gotten the full electronic file, right? We could have made the comparison, and then there wouldn't have been an admissibility problem. But again, the court played both sides of the coin against us. It said, you don't get the full electronic file, but I'm going to allow a summary. And by the way, that summary, not in Red K's affidavit, not in Wojciak's affidavit. We don't know where it came from or what it is, but it's the only document that has her account allegedly being transferred. And there is no evidence establishing the admissibility of that document. The FDCPA is strict liability. The cases on the strict liability are in our principal brief. It's not a question of whether or not under Donahue, it's misleading to no one. It's a question of, did they comply with the law? That's what the Simon case says. That's what Klein v. SCJ said. And when they failed to comply with the law, they violated the FDCPA. And those are important rights, not just to Ms. Ford. She's not seeking to avoid her debt for the violation of the FDCPA. She's seeking vindication of her federally protected rights. She should have been permitted the reasonable discovery. The 5604 motion should have been granted. It's fundamentally unfair to deny the appellant the discovery it needs for summary judgment and then grant the summary judgment using the very evidence that was the basis of the 5604 motion. We wanted to get at, was this truthful or not? The federal government has already told you they're not truthful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted, and we'll have our decision out within the statutory time frame.